Hello, and welcome to Seedheads, the cross-pollinating podcast where our Canadian seed heroes tell their stories, share their how-to tips, and talk about the seeds they love. I'm your host, Steph Benoit, coming to you from Ottawa, Ontario, on the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. In today's episode, I had the joy of talking to Craig Boychuk. Craig is a seed grower, plant breeder, and the owner-operator of No Coast Seeds, located in Calder, Saskatchewan, in Treaty 4 territory, the lands of the Nehiyawak, Anishinaabe, Dakota, Lakota, and Nokota, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. In this episode, we talked about Craig's experience as a vegetable seed grower in the prairies, some lessons from his first year owning and operating his own seed company, how he started growing and saving seeds, some of his favorite varieties from his farm, and what he's looking forward to in 2024. It was really fun to record this episode and get the opportunity to talk to someone just on the tail end of their first year of selling seeds. As always, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy. You're in a very unique situation, and we don't often get to the opportunity to talk to people in your exact situation, and that is you are on the tail end of your first year of selling seeds, which
yes,
I'm sure comes with a lot of lessons and stories and lots of wisdom to impart. So I was hoping that to begin with, you could tell me a little bit about your seed company and how your first season went.
Yeah, sure. The seed company is called No Coast Seeds, and I have actually been working on this project since 2019, as you say. This year was my first year selling seeds. So I'm growing open pollinated seeds for short seasons. Within that umbrella, I'm focusing on contemporary cultivars, like not too many heirloom varieties, although I do have a few that I like, just, you know, favorites and things that work really well here. Yeah, so newer stuff, diverse gene pool mixes. I'm just really into big, broad mixes, both just kind of in and of themselves, because I think they're awesome, but also as a means to generate interesting material for breeding projects. I have quite a number of breeding projects on the go that I'm pretty excited about. And we also have a focus on OSSI pledged varieties, and some of the stuff that we're working on is OSSI pledged as well. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing in a nutshell.
For those who don't know, could you explain what OSSI is and why it was important to you to have your seeds committed to them?
Yes, OSSI is the Open Source Seed Initiative. They're dedicated to maintaining fair and open access to plant genetic resources worldwide in order to ensure the availability of germplasm to farmers, gardeners, breeders, and communities of this and future generations, which basically comes down to sharing rather than restriction, like in terms of intellectual property controls like patents and other protections. Any variety that has the OSSI pledge, you are free to use that material in any way that you choose, as long as you do not restrict others from using that material in the same way. And then the pledge is supposed to follow the seeds around as they are kind of dispersed into the wild. I think that, you know, patenting life seems kind of weird, and, you know, it restricts farmers and breeders access to genetics that I, you know, should truly be available to all. It's kind of another sort of like less political reason for it is just that there's so many cool OSSI pledge varieties. And I also found it was an interesting, or a convenient way to kind of like limit my scope in a way. Just, it's a good screen to kind of be like, okay, well, I'll concentrate on this stuff. And then it just, you know, it automatically narrows things down, which is helpful in a sea of, yeah, lots of options.
You put it really well on your website as well. I've told you before, and I'll say it again for the listeners, but I think you have like one of the coolest seed websites that I've seen.
I recommend
to check it out, because yeah, just like such comprehensive information about who you are and what you're doing and the varieties you work with. On the website, you had mentioned that unless you take a plant from the wild, you know, sort of this untouched area, then there's someone who's come before you who has bred that seed or handled that seed. And I love that idea of like, yeah, there's so many hands who have touched this seed before it's gotten to you. And it's, in my opinion, so valuable to acknowledge that and to continue to allow the next generations who come after us to continue to work with this material that we are not the sole creator of.
Yeah, totally. And attribution is one of the things that you're supposed to do as a, you know, an OSSI company partner. Is you want to list all the breeder names and all mm-hmm. the people that were involved in creating that variety, which I think is very cool. And in attribution in general, I think is a really powerful means for, I guess, like, it kind of all comes down to like to seed quality, because like then you can know, you can know where things are coming from, you're giving credit where credit is due, and then it's just, I don't know, it improves the utility of the seed because you have the background behind it. And then there's that like nice ethical pat on the back for like, you know, recognizing all the people that came before you. But yeah, that's been something that's really helped me a lot in my breeding work, and something that I'm trying to kind of reciprocate as well, is a lot of folks will offer populations or like early populations or works in progress that are a very convenient starting point for anybody wanting to do some breeding work that kind of aligns with what's in that population. So it's a really great way to shave years off of a project if you can have access to those things. And I've really appreciated being able to, you know, use that kind of material from other breeders and growers. And so I'm trying to make my works in progress available as well to folks that are mm-hmm. looking to do more kind of experimental stuff. So
we've gotten maybe a bit away from your farm and your project, but I want to hear more of like the specifics. It's got such a fun name as well, No Coast Seeds, referencing to your location in the middle of the country. What made you want to be a vegetable farmer in a sea of grain?
I desired a rural existence, but a lot of the kind of like typical things that you think about when you imagine doing that didn't really appeal to me. Like, I didn't really want to be a grain farmer. I didn't really want to keep animals. Don't really want to just like live in the country and have a city job. Don't mm-hmm. really want to be a market gardener. but what I did want to do was have a garden. The cool thing about seeds is that you get to do a lot of gardening. Basically, it takes gardening to the whole next level, because you're going beyond the vegetable crop into seeing the full life cycle of the plant up to the mm-hmm. point where it produces seed, which I think is very interesting and kind of magical. It was kind of the thing that appealed to me the most out of all the things that I could think of that I might do out in the country. Seed work you can do on a small scale, the product isn't perishable. It can be really doable on a human scale, which was kind of my aim. And then kind of so on top of all those like nice practical reasons why I liked it, it's also kind of just the epitome of right livelihood, sort mm-hmm. of. Growing food is very important because everybody has to eat. And then there's also food security and promoting agrobiodiversity, promoting things like OSSI, working against restrictions on genetic material. There's just so many like really worthwhile, meaningful pursuits that are built into seed work. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was cool. And it just makes it really easy to feel good about doing it.
Kind of being like in a unique situation as a seed, like a vegetable seed grower in your area, do you find that there's been a network that supported you, both like sort of a formal, any institutional networks or just a network of other seed breeders in the area?
I'm in kind of a weird location where there's no real major centers nearby. Like the closest thing would be Saskatoon, 4 hours away, and then Winnipeg, 5 hours kind of in the other direction-ish. So it's a little lonely in that regard. And then there's not a lot of seed growers on the prairies, but some folks that have been really supportive and were kind of my first point of contact into this world was Jim and Rochelle Tournier of Prairie Garden Seeds, who have been very, very supportive and really generous mentors. As I've kind of gone along, I've met a few other growers. I've met some folks in the Bauta initiative that have been rather quite helpful. Tira and Iris, specifically, they're kind of my main points of contact, and they're awesome. They rule and have hooked me up with some cool opportunities. And I just recently started working with a group of growers that are, across North America. A lot of them are in the States, and we just started getting some more folks from Canada going. It's a seed worker organizing group. Basically, it's kind of like a mutual aid group. It's just a bunch of seed growers that got together. It came to be out of a session in the last OSA conference about contract growing, and we decided to do another breakout session, and then we all wanted to keep working on this idea of contract recommendations. So we've been meeting monthly ever since then, and we've got a couple other small projects on the go. But that's been really cool because I've got to meet a bunch of folks from the States, where there is a lot more seed growing happening. Got to meet some of my seed heroes. I'd say those were kind of the main things. And then I'm just also Young Agrarians has been really good too. Mm. Those folks there, I did a couple of business things through them.
I'm curious now that you've mentioned it, who your seed heroes are.
I'm pretty enamored with the Experimental Farm Network. I think the work that they're doing is very cool. Frank Morton is, I follow his work. Yeah, classic, the lettuce hero of all time. and he's also, he's one of the people that are really free with their work in progress material. I've gotten a lot of stuff from him that's just freely available, and that rules. And so, trying to do the same thing. Carol Deppi, I really was quite inspired by her book, How to Breed Your Own Vegetable Varieties, I believe is the title. Yeah, the breeding book. It's great. And Joseph Lofthouse, when I was just started learning about seed saving and isolation and things, and I was getting down about the distance that you have to put between certain things, and I was like, oh man, this is so hard. And then I learned about Joseph Lofthouse and about the whole landrace gardening thing. And I was like, yes, I don't have to isolate anything. I just grow it all together and it'll be great. That was pretty fun. And of course, it's not that simple, obviously, but those are some of the, and adaptive seeds too. I really like how they are, searching out kind of lost varieties and just kind of unusual things from days past and kind of bringing stuff back into circulation.
On that note, why is regional seed important to you? Or why do you believe in the relevance of regional seed?
I think it just comes down largely to climate adaptability right now, especially. Just having cultivars that were developed in your area, I think gives you a better chance for success. Doesn't necessarily guarantee success, and that doesn't necessarily mean that stuff from far, far away isn't going to be suitable. Yeah, regional adaptation, I think, is really important. But also just in the terms of kind of decentralizing seed production and having lots of seed production everywhere, I think will just add to the resilience of the whole system. So a lot of the reasons that it's something that you'd like in food production kind of applies to seed production as well.
So out of this first year, what were some of the big learning curves, or what are some of the big lessons that you're taking away from year uno?
Well, workload has been hard to dial in a way that seems manageable. I think I'm getting there. Also just recognizing that growing seeds and selling seeds are really two different jobs. As much as I want it to be one job, it's really two jobs. And so trying to square yourself with that is important in order to not be killed by the workload. Those are probably the most challenging things in terms of the actual production and stuff. I had another really bad year of Aster Yellows that decimated all my lettuce and some other things. Aster Yellows is a bacterial disease that kind of acts like a virus and such that it's transmitted by sap-sucking insects. It's not seed-borne, fortunately, in my case, it's it deforms the flowers and the plants don't make seed, and it can have other kind of side effects as well. But like the biggest thing is like no seed. The whole like temperature thing has been challenging, not just this year, but other years. Like, you know, sometimes it's hot at a bad time for pollination, and then you don't get the same kind of seed set that you want on a particular crop. I've been finding that's kind of cropping up in ways that I haven't noticed before.
Because you were also, I mean, you've been farming and having a garden and breeding, working on breeding projects for many years now before even selling your seeds, correct?
Yeah, this is year six. I started this project winter 2018, I guess. Yeah. And then my first year of like real serious seed growing was 2019. And I'd been gardening for a long time before that serious seed production began then.
And then that became your full-time job?
Yes, it did.
Was that an intimidating leap to make?
I guess so. I would have probably done it a little differently, truth be told. But like, I was just transitioning out of a seasonal job as a lookout observer in Alberta for wildfires and trying to kind of get out of that seasonal thing. I was trying to figure out what to do, and I'd kind of had this idea rolling around in my head. And so, you know, made the plan, moved out here, started working, and then the pandemic kind of put a wrench into things. So I just kind of like hit out on the farm. It would have been good to like being able to be a little more social and like have a little more mentorship, have a little more interaction with my neighbor. Like I don't really know a lot of my neighbors even yet out here, because I've just been stuck on the farm and working so hard and just kind of head down. So I'm trying to, you know, make a little more effort to like get out and actually see what's going on. Because all that happened, I was just like, whatever, I'm going to, you know, go for it. And I don't think that's necessarily, I wish I had a little more of a plan when I got into it, but I'm happy I did it, I guess, long story short.
Sounds sort of like baptism by fire, like suddenly you're in it.
Yeah, I mean, like I knew I wanted to do this. It was just kind of a question of like, how quickly can I make it a viable living? If I would have been able to launch a little sooner, that might have been good. But then at the same time, you know, there's more time to like refine stuff and kind of dial things in. Like I feel like having that time made me quite a bit more confident in what I'm doing and my product and my knowledge. And just like, you know, like I feel pretty good about the seeds that I'm growing. And I feel like I wouldn't be feeling that way if I hadn't taken time.
That's kind of, yeah, that's a beautiful way of looking at it. It's a nice little silver lining.
I guess I kind of look at it like I decided to just, I put myself through school, you know.
You've participated in a few variety trials. Can you tell me a bit about your experience with that?
Yeah, I've been working with Canovi on, I've been done quite a number of years of carrot trials, I guess, maybe 3-4 years, I guess. And we've also done radicchio. And this year, lettuce, heat tolerant lettuce. I was also working on a participatory breeding project that I kind of got in on the tail end and wasn't too heavily involved in that, but that was also a Canovi thing. And that was for acorn squash. I didn't get to like really chat with that group a whole lot, but I do have this kind of cool population of like variously colored acorn squashes, which is kind of neat. Yeah, I might try to revive that project this year.
Do you feel like those variety trials are like the format of connecting with other growers, simultaneously growing things out, has helped you as sort of like a beginner to widen your network or to be able to learn from peer exchange, that sort of stuff?
It's been interesting to compare results, and I've found as I've gone along, my results get closer to the averages. Which is like, oh, okay, I think I'm being a little better with my techniques and stuff. But you know, some stuff works great here and doesn't work well elsewhere, and that kind of like speaks to the whole regional specialty kind of thing. Moving forward, I would really like to see some of my stuff be trialed by other growers. And so I'm looking forward to hopefully at some point, maybe not this year, but like getting some of my stuff into the hands of other people, and like now I'm collecting the data. it'd be fun and super informative as well, and I think pretty important part of the process in developing
mm-hmm.
new
Sending
varieties.
your babies out into the world.
Yeah, see how they actually perform.
So of the varieties that you've been working on and breeding and tinkering with, do you have any favorites, any that sort of stand out to you as projects that you've really enjoyed working on or have had unexpected outcomes?
I'm glad you asked. There are many. It's hard to decide what to talk about, but a lot of the stuff I'm working on is still early on in its evolution. But one of the things that are more that is more come along a little further is the bicolor zucchini, which I am tentatively titling Double Happiness Zucchini. It is a yellow and green zucchini, and the goal is basically just to have a half green, half yellow zucchini. Because why? Because it looks cool. And also the two halves, like the flesh is different. Like
Oh,
you'll
interesting.
yeah. So there's like kind of two different flavor profiles sometimes.
Is it sort of like a top half, bottom half, or is it
Top half,
like
bottom
a
half, yeah.
Oh, interesting. I when you first said that,
Some
I was envisioning it sort of tie-dyed.
yeah, there I have seen some like that. I found like three main phenotypes that I thought were pretty cool. That all involve like a top half, bottom half, and then there's like just a small handful of tie-dyed ones, but I didn't like them and I threw them out. Didn't want them. I'm sorry.
Well, next
But
time you're about to throw them out, you can send the seeds my way.
yes, I will. So yeah, I'm basically just working towards trying to stabilize some lines. So like when I started out, this and of course all these selections come from my zucchini surprise. Zucchini population, which, as you can imagine, is just a whole bunch of red or yellow and green zucchinis intermingling and interbreeding. And so from there, I let that. I actually just looked at my notes on this this morning, so I could actually talk about it. But I don't know where I put them. Anyway, so I let them kind of cross up for. Oh, here it is. Yeah, for three. It started out in 2019, and it was just I let them kind of randomly cross-pollinate. And then the next 2 years, I started doing random hand pollinations, just to kind of like encourage the yellow and green combos. I would just, just cross different plants. And then in 2022, I started like more deliberately selecting out bicolor maternal lines, because I hadn't really done any super control. I was doing hand pollinations, but I wasn't like tagging them or anything. I was just wanted to create diversity. But this time I started hand pollinating them, either with themselves or with another plant of a similar color phenotype. And then again this year I chose a bunch of my favorites from those lines, and I'm doing the same thing. And I'm going to be narrowing it down to, I think, just two of the three color phenotypes, because I don't know, I like them better.
What is the difference in the flesh between the two colors?
Yeah, the green ones tend to be quite pale, like a white or a cream color, and the yellow ones can be anywhere from like a kind of yellow ivory to like a more of a deep orange. There's actually a fair bit of variation in the yellow plants in this population in terms of the flesh, like density and flavor. Actually, all pretty delish. Some of them are like a little more kind of spaghetti squash like. But anyway, so like when I started out, I was getting about maybe 5%, maybe not even, of bicolor plants just kind of like happening naturally. And now it's about a 3-to-1 ratio of bicolor to solid color plants, which is, that's trucking along. So it's cool to have results on paper that are like, yes, this is actually progressing. Because after a few years, sometimes you kind of just lose track, You got to take meticulous notes. But yeah, anyway, so that's where that one's at. And I'm pretty excited to kind of move that along. But the two color phenotypes are, one is just like pretty much straight up half and half, like a real defined line, yellow green. And the other one has got kind of like a flame pattern of the green on top.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so that's pretty cool. And then the one that I'm discarding had just kind of green tips, like on the cap, but like not a whole lot of green. I wanted it more flashy.
Intrigued by the Guy Fieri sounding one with the flames coming up.
Yeah, it's yeah. Sometimes it's kind of like that. I mean, I never thought of it that way. That's been cool because a lot of the stuff I'm working on is like sort of more mass selection projects where there's not a lot of like super intentional crossing and control of pollen. So it's been fun to kind of do more of that. I'm like a real off-type enthusiast. Like I love to find the weird plant in the bunch and then grow the seeds from that and see what happens, which is what happened with my lemonade cascade bean. It's a pole bean, a pole snap bean, but it's also very good as a dry bean. And it arose from a single off-type in a cascade giant population. I just noticed this one plant that had this kind of nice pinkish tinge to it. Cascade giants is like a yellow, like Romano kind of flat style slicer pole bean. So one of these plants had this like really cool crimson tinge. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to save that. And then I planted that out and it gave me this crazy cornucopia of colors. Just that there is 16 different color combinations plus white seeds. Yeah. The next year. So my theory is that that would have been my, like a chance cross. And then the following year when I grew it out was the F2 generation, which is segregated into all these crazy colors. But, you know, that's my hypothesis. And so I was started trying to weed out the white seeds because I just thought it looked cool without the white seeds. It's layers like these blue beans and sort of greenish, like olive green and yellow and tan. It's just a really weird kind of color combination. But so just removing them didn't do anything. They just came back in this basically the same ratio as before, even after just selecting them out. So I started looking into bean color genetics, which it turns out are quite complicated. I'm still having trouble wrapping my head around it. But what I could do is isolate or separate all the different colors and grow them out on their own and try to figure out if there was any particular kind of bean that's consistently giving white seeds. And so I did that this year and figured out which ones are throwing off the white seeds. So now if I want, I can remove those from the population and have my non-white seeded lemonade cascade beans, if I so choose. But I think what I'm actually going to do is follow some of the other lines out, because there's this one that's got blue, these really just awesome looking blue beans, but some show up in tan. It's like just total like khaki tan. And the color combination is, it just looks so cool. I can't describe it, but yeah, it's neat. So I think I might try keeping that population whole and like separating out some of the other interesting colors. It's nice when, you know, just a random thing that happens in the garden can turn into this like crazy treasure hunt.
Something else that I was wondering, on your website, I was reading a little bit about that you have Ukrainian heritage. And I was wondering if you had any stories that you wanted to share related to your Ukrainian heritage and being many generations on the prairies as farmers.
Yes. I don't know if it's like Ukrainian specific, but it probably is. It's kind of a stereotype. I don't mind sharing it because I think it's very endearing. And so anyway, I'm on this farm that my great grandfather was one of the like first white settler pioneers in this area, which is in Treaty 4 territory. So it's basically, it started as a subsistence farm and has eventually, like they had animals and sort of like a small, really small grain operation at first. And it's sort of grown from there into a organic grain farm. There was sort of like a cattle was a thing that happened for a fair bit as well. But my uncle isn't doing the cattle anymore. It's just grain. So yeah, anyway, it's three, how many is that? Four generations, I guess, my number four.
Wow.
Yeah, something like that. The thing that I really noticed being here, because I'm in this house where my grandmother lived and my mom grew up, and my uncle, who still lives here, grew up. And there's just all kinds of artifacts everywhere, like little notes that my grandma would write and just like leave around. Seeds, actually, I found a whole bunch of seeds that she saved.
Whoa.
I want to try planting and see if I can revive anything. I've got like a couple boxes of stuff. Sometimes I still find jars of them, just kind of like, I was cleaning out a shed this summer and I found some seeds in a random jar. So yeah, there's all, I guess what it comes down to is, as you know, when you're out here breaking the land and stuff, times are tight and there is just a real like kind of scarcity mindset, I guess, and people really, there was like zero waste. Everything, do not throw things away. Everything gets saved and gets used for something else. I feel like a lot of other Ukrainian families had that same kind of mindset because they, you know, they came over and their family was like, you know, really scraping it to get by. And then that turns into this, in my case, this kind of like the hoarder tendency, at least in my family here. But then I'm finding all this like really interesting family info and all this other stuff. So it's just kind of it's interesting how that the progression from like, you know, not wasting things to keep by kind of turned into keeping all of these like mementos and keepsakes in history and stuff. So that's kind of what I think about a lot of the time when I think about Ukrainians on the prairies, because that's like, I'm sort of in this time capsule of my family, sort of, with all these, you know, and when I say artifacts, I just mean like whatever bits and bobs and like weird things, old toys, you know, just like, yeah.
So, oh my gosh, the idea of finding seeds that your grandmother had saved is like finding undeveloped film or something. It's like, yeah. Oh my gosh, what is this going to turn into?
Yeah.
Like, is it going to work? Is it going to be anything? That would be so exciting. I would love to hear how that ends up.
I've been afraid to kind of like dive into it because, like, you know, I want to like make sure I got enough time to like really give it full attention and like baby those seeds and give them all the special treatment they deserve. But when I think about Ukrainians on the prairie, it's like saving stuff for just in case. And now I'm using all this, like, you know, there's piles of paper bags and all this stuff that my mom used to be like, as if, you know, why don't you get rid of all this stuff? But now I'm actually I'm using a lot of the stuff that my grandmother saved. So it's kind of satisfying.
Satisfying or just like, I don't know, it feels kind of full circle where like our grandparents oftentimes were raised in like that scarcity mindset. And now we're kind of like getting back to understanding the necessity of hanging on to things and realizing that, you know, our resources are finite and we have to try to find creative ways to use things more than once and some of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
My grandma has been a big influence in my relationship with seeds, and it's just very cool that that sort of stuff can be passed down over generations. I can only imagine how cool it is to be in like literally the farmhouse and on the same land that your ancestors landed on and grew up in and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. You know, I wish I could talk to my grandma about what I'm doing here, but you know, it's the next best thing, I guess, if I'm able to do it. And there's a bunch of, you know, she's got some perennials out there that I get to tend to, and so she's still around in a way, I suppose. In the trees, actually, she used to put tin cans around cucumbers for like for cutworms and stuff. There's all these like strings of old rusty tin cans like hanging in the forest just next to where one of the gardens is. It's kind of it's kind of cool. Weird little, I don't know, strange talismans.
I was wondering, for people in your area or people further afield who are interested in purchasing some of your seeds, what have been your main ways of selling? Have you been doing like the CD Saturday hitting the pavement sort of route? You have an online store. Have you been doing some contract growing? What has that looked like?
Yes, good question. Sales are largely directed through the website, although CD Saturday was a substantial portion of sales for sure. Yeah, so mostly, honestly, mostly just those two avenues. I would like to see if I can get a rack going in like one or two of the local garden centers. I wasn't really too sure what to do or how it would go or like how much energy I would have for that end of it. Because, you know, being that it is job number two and
right.
production is really what I'm interested in. It's been good. I've actually been surprised at like how the kind of like just natural traffic went through there. Yeah, I feel like I definitely have some a lot of room for improvement.
How are you feeling looking forward to 2024 and your second season selling?
Second selling season. Yes, I am looking forward to like just dialing in that workload so I don't feel like I'm going to collapse. I think it's going to be awesome. I've identified a bunch of things where I can like, I think I can like make a real difference. So that's going to roll. I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see, have another sales year to compare to and like see who gets interested and see like, are repeat customers going to be a thing? I hope so. You know, but like, what's that going to look like? I don't know. I'm looking forward to continuing some collaboration with other growers. I've been working a little bit with friend Ryan Galvin, who does a small seed project called Tiny Monster Garden, which is just in Lorette, just outside of Winnipeg. We started working on a tomato project this year, trying to stabilize a couple lines of things that I'm working on that I had like selected from another project. And I might be doing some work with a grower near Saskatoon, hopefully. It's still in the works, but yeah, like I'm looking forward to like talk and shop with other people, other growers, and just like kind of getting out there a little bit more.
Well,
because I'm going to actually have time because I'm going to nail the workload. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Great.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with your upcoming season.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Seedheads is produced by the Bauda Family Initiative on Canadian Seed Security, a program of Seed Change, whose main office is located on the traditional, unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. To find episode transcripts and learn more about seed work in Canada, please visit seedsecurity.ca.